Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great. I'm great.
I want today to talk about a restaurant review, and we don't do this all the time, but once in a while a restaurant review comes along that is either very interesting or indicative of a larger trend, and I think this is both. we had the people from Time Out New York for an interview recently, and we talked about their the restaurant star scene is changing in New York a little bit. Time Out New York, it was always the Michelin guide, Le Guide Michelin, it was always three stars in Europe, and now they're reviewing in New York as well. So we have a one, two, or three stars. Where even gaining one star from them is, you know, puts you in an upper echelon of restaurants. We have the New York Times is always the gold standard, and the New York Times was is a four star based on four stars. Then Time Out New York, to bring their New York publication in line with their London and their foreign publications, Time Out London, et cetera, and so forth, have moved to a six-star system. And New York Times Magazine, not to miss out on the fray, has instituted for the first time a five-star system. Is that anybody confused yet? 3 stars from Michelin, very good. 3 stars from Time Out, not so good.
Okay. Exactly, not so good.
But in the new star system, one of the first reviews in New York Magazine is by Adam Platt of a restaurant called Japonais. No stars, okay?
No stars.
No stars is the same in all of the publications. but this is another big box Asian eatery in the meatpacking district in New York.
None.
Very, very trendy.
Big box Asian eatery.
Yes. Yeah, why would anybody spend a lot? That charges a lot of money, and they're making money. The owner lives in a nicer house than you do, Mark. So
yes, I'm well aware, because I can't afford to build a big box Asian eatery in the meatpacking district of New York City.
That people will go to even if the food isn't good. Here's from Adam Platt's review. As I sat at Japonais sipping my floating orchid martini, groping for new ways to describe the latest glossy pan-Asian disco palace to land in our midst. A dish appeared that was so misconceived, so eccentric, so downright flat-footed that it did the job for me. The Wagyu beef Toban Yaki style. What did he say? It comes to the table in a steaming clay vessel. The lid is then lifted with ceremony to reveal a dank melange of peppers, mushrooms, and the beef itself simmered to a dull gray nothingness in a broth described as Kirin light beer fondue. Sound gross yet? Yes.
Oops.
I took one hesitant bite and then another, and then I scribbled down, and whenever a restaurant critic scribbles this down, it's a bad thing. I scribbled the following cosmic question. What am I doing here?
You know, if you're a diner and you're in that situation, I'm not feeling well, and I think it might be because of your cooking. No, just say, I'm not feeling well, I think I need to go.
But he's the restaurant reviewer. He had to stay, and Japonais is the restaurant. It's on 18th Street off Park Avenue. It's gimmick-laden, and, you know, one of the things that's very interesting, these guys spend millions of dollars, and they make millions of dollars, but here are some gimmicks that he talks about.
Well, you can't lift a lid ceremoniously off a dank melange of peppers and mushrooms. You just can't do it.
The idea is the focus here isn't on the food, and they're on gimmicks. So you have a place called Japonais in New York, which is French for Japanese in New York.
Right, and it's not French or Japanese or...
Or
New York.
So what does that have to do with the food? And so he talks about having entrees like les soupes, les salades, and then sort of Western salads and soups with like a splash of soy sauce in there, and that's supposed to make it. That's supposed to make it
Japanese.
So I don't understand it, I think that when you do gimmicks, he talks about another gimmick, and I want to talk about gimmicks because there's some stuff that we do at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. Like we started pouring 20-year-old balsamic vinegar tableside, you know, dropping it on things that need it. Well, why is that? It's because when it's dropped on, you see it dropped on right in front of you. You know it's very special. It controls the portion, and it makes it taste better done that way.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example of another restaurant that I've been to recently, Restaurant Nicholas in Red Bank. Brings out a Staub cast iron pot for you. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens? He's cooked a lot of the food he's finished that food in the cast iron pot. So when he opens that cast iron pot, you get the aromas and the steam that comes out of the cast iron pot. And that's why he serves it to you that way.
And so here, to counterpoint, this is from Adam Platt's review of Japonais. I very much enjoyed my sampling of Wagyu carpaccio, which is like a raw beef.
Pounded thin beef.
But the little strips of sirloin cooked on a piping hot rock, listed under Le Spécialité de la Maison in the Japanese restaurant, tasted more or less like, well, little strips of sirloin cooked on anything else.
Well, you know what I don't understand? The whole appeal of, like, cooking on a rock. Like, what's the point of that? I mean, I understand it's cool to cook on something like that. If you're 9 years old and it's a really hot day in the summer and you want to cook an egg on the sidewalk, that's like the only reason that I can see to ever cook anything on a rock.
It's a gimmick. And that's, you know what the gimmick is? The gimmick is it doesn't bring anything to the food. It doesn't enhance your enjoyment of the dish at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if someone finishes a sauce tableside, it's because it's a very delicate sauce, hopefully, that, you know, you finish it and you put it on the dish. If someone fillets a Dover sole or any piece of fish for you tableside, it's to have it cooked on the bone and left on the bone, which changes the flavor of the mm-hmm. fish to the last minute. And if that's rolled over and then filleted tableside for you, then and then sauced a la minute, which is, you know, mm-hmm. Right at the last minute,
mm-hmm.
that changes the food. Cooking strips of sirloin on a hot rock, what's the point? You know,
right. We look at saucing tableside. Let's just take that as an example. Why do we choose to sauce certain things tableside? Well, there may be an aesthetic to the plate before it's sauced, or like by pouring a consommé into a bowl. There may be an aesthetic there that we want you to see. Or you sauce tableside because the sauce is going to change the dish relatively quickly. And if it's sauced 2 minutes earlier in the kitchen, you may miss one of the components, one of the layers that's going to happen in your dish.
If you're going to open a Japanese restaurant, you know, you've got to kind of follow through with the theme. That doesn't mean you call a Japonais, put on a lot of loud music, and then throw soy sauce on your steak. That does not make it a Japanese restaurant.
Hold on, I got to read the from now. In the end, is no stars. He gives the address, the hours, the prices, the ideal meal, a note for drinks to go upstairs, and a scratch pad. The best food here is designed nightclub style to be eaten with drinks. For real dinner, go somewhere else.
And you will find this. No, actually, you're not going to find a link to this on our website at all. We would never do that. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today, David Menzel, is a renowned photographer whose works appeared in Time, Newsweek, The New York Times Magazine, etc., etc. He's married to Faith DeLisio, who was a television news producer and award-winning documentarian and is now a writer. They've collaborated on a number of projects, most notable for The Restaurant Guys, their books Man-Eating Bugs, The Art and Science of Eating Insects, and most recently Hungry Planet, What the World Eats, for which they traveled the world and then documented and photographed 30 families in 24 countries, each family with its weekly supply of food laid out before it.
David and Faith, welcome to the show.
Hello, and it's actually Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucia.
Oh, look at that.
Look at that.
Yeah, so it's Bill and Tom we're talking to?
Yeah.
Very nice.
Give me the research assistant on the phone immediately.
Very nice.
And see, so, it's really important you get it right because both of my parents were born in New Jersey, and I have a lot of family.
All right.
Excellent.
Guido's going to come in.
Yeah, I was going to say, the phone's lighting up here.
Picks up pretty soon.
So now I have a question for you. Now, we brought you on to talk about Hungry Planet, of course, but is that your first book? Is it Man-Eating Bugs or Man-Eating Bugs?
Well, our first book was called Material World, A Global Family Portrait.
Mm-hmm.
And the third or fourth book was called Man-Eating Bugs, The Art and Science of Eating Insects.
And it is a little play on words, and we did indeed eat them, they didn't eat us.
Well, that's
it's
that's,
better that way.
Thank God. Then we'd have to have the bugs on the show. That would be very different.
Well, you don't know that you haven't. You were just talking on the radio, right?
That's true. That's true. Now,
you could indeed be the bugs.
I hate to go for the low-hanging fruit, but with Hungry Planet, What the World Eats, which is where you've gone around the world documenting what people eat in the course of a week in different cultures and different countries. One of the things that strikes me about this beautiful book is to look at the difference in quantity of food people eat in different parts of the world.
If you get more money, you eat more food.
Well, and that leads to some problems as well, doesn't it?
Of course, sure.
Well, it has in America, and it's spreading around most of the world. 70% of Americans are now overweight, and 30 or 40% of us are deemed obese. But the more a culture makes as far as income goes, the more they're going to spend on fatty foods, protein, and sugary foods too.
Now, when you started this project, when you decided to go out and document what the world eats, did you have a point in mind that you were trying to make?
Which we really actually try not to make points per se. What we like to do is just show people the world, and all of our books basically do that. But generally, what happened was is that we travel about 8 months of the year out of the country for our projects, and every time we would come home, we'd go to a grocery store, of course, first thing you do, pick up your stuff, and we realized how big people were. And every year it seemed, over the last 10 or 15 years, people just seemed to be getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, we were in other countries, and we didn't see that. We didn't see Americans for a long time, and it kind of surprised us, and that was the reason why we wanted to sort of see what everybody in the world was eating.
Is it changing around the world, though, or are you seeing...
Yeah, everybody is following our bad behavior.
Yeah, and in the year 2000, one of the things that really kicked us off on this project was a World Watch report that said that there were, at that time, as many overfed people as underfed people. And that's since tipped to the overfed part, so there's now more people in the world that are eating too much rather than too little.
I'm not sure I'm happy about that.
Yeah. Well, you know...
how many of them are going to your restaurant?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. One of the things, it's an interesting thing that we point out is that it tends to be wealthy people, and, you know, our restaurant's not inexpensive, but it tends to be poor people who are the disproportionately affected by obesity and increasing...
Well, poor people in wealthy nations.
Exactly, because, you know, part of it is sort of food literacy, which is a really important concept, and just knowing that that the more money you have as a culture, the more apt your culture is going to be sold to by food corporations that are basically making up their own mind about what you need to eat. And then as part of that, as you become more food literate and you realize, well, maybe I shouldn't be eating things with high fructose corn syrup because it's hidden, it's not something that is, you know, historically been all that good for you, you make certain decisions about your life. That's not a decision that a lot of more poor people in a wealthy country are really making it.
Well, and
people with less money are going into the supermarket and they're not steering themselves right to the fresh produce. They're going to the center of the store that has the processed foods that are, you know, to give them more bang for their buck. And unfortunately, there's a lot less fiber and there's more fat and sugar in all those foods.
Well, and I also think that, as cultures become disrupted, people start, you know, if they maybe didn't have the food literacy to know why exactly they ate the foods they ate in their traditional societies, the traditional wisdom sort of kept people on balance. And when that's replaced with advertising to make your food choices, it can lead to pretty negative ramifications.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were in the Chad at a refugee camp with...
Actually, that's one of the most interesting pictures in the book, and when we come back after the break, I want to talk more about that. We're with Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio about their book, Hungry Planet, What the World Eats. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their quality clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see, you need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hey, back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Our guests today are Peter Menzel and Faith DeLuzio. Their book is Hungry Planet, What the World Eats. We were talking just before the break about how when people may not make the best choices once advertising comes into to their culture and when they get away from their traditional foods. And you were talking about Chad. Why don't you pick that up?
Yeah, Chad was interesting because they eat traditionally. And across the border, their very near relatives in the Darfur region, the refugees there and in Chad, are eating exactly the same types of food. It's an esh, it's a grain porridge, and which is traditional. But in a refugee camp, they have to start eating sort of what the world gives them, which they're very thankful for, and in fact, they wish they had more. But, you know, it really depends on they have to depend on the world, but they're eating traditionally. What happens, though, is that if you go into the more urban places around Africa, you'll see that foods from the global marketplace are making inroads. And it really is kind of surprising, I think, the first time that you see, you know, ramen noodles in a package in a store or in a little convenience store and people actually buying them. There's nothing wrong with it in, say, the first world, the so-called first world or the developed world, but you really have to start wondering if this is a good food choice for people to be making when they don't really have any information at all about the little flavor packet and what exactly it is.
Well, and, you know, like you said, it's the hidden ingredients that are contained in food. And when people are divorced from their traditional cultural moorings in making food choices, and they also don't have the tools to make choices in our global marketplace as to what's good for you and how to balance proteins and carbohydrates and the importance of fresh vegetables, they're really at sea in it. And the only way they can make the choice is by the marketing of the producer.
Exactly. That's a very good point. And it's not something that we get a lot of help with here in this country, unfortunately, and I would imagine they're getting even less in other countries, because if you look just at the proximity of Mexico, for example, to the United States, they have a lot of our bad habits just because of their location. And if you look, for example, at our family in Mexico, Alma was shocked to find out that basically the Coca-Cola she was feeding her kids three meals a day and 16 meals as well. You can see it lined up in the picture across the back of their week's worth of food.
Yeah, it's 6 gallons a week.
She had no idea that it was just sugar water.
Yeah, I want to talk more about our effects on the rest of the world.
More with David Menzel and Faith DeLuzio. After the news, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Peter Menzel and Faith DeLuzio have joined us to talk about their book, Hungry Planet, What the World Eats, for which they traveled the world and then documented and photographed 30 families in 24 countries, each family with its entire weekly food supply laid out before it. Now, Peter and Faith, when people laid out a whole week's worth of groceries for their family in front of them, were they surprised at all? Were people ever surprised?
Quite often they were, because a lot of people don't shop by the week, they shop by the day. So what we did is Faith did rather lengthy interviews finding out what people had for a typical breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then we went shopping with them and bought the food for a week and then these large photographs in their homes.
Did you find here in the United States, frequently people will shop for a week, mm-hmm. and we expect our food to last for a week and to be processed and stable for a week. And so did you find that people in the United States guessed a little better at what their food consumption for a week was over people in other places?
No, actually, it took a lot more time to think about it, A, because they were buying a lot more stuff,
mm-hmm.
and B, we have a lot more variety. In most countries, the variety is actually very narrow, and that research has, I think, proven that is maybe actually one of the keys to obesity, is having that incredible variety, which seems to sort of fly in the face of what mm-hmm. you would think. But no, it's you were exactly right. People in this country were completely shocked, really, when they saw the incredible amount of food on a table, and they didn't quite believe it. So in a couple of cases, we would go back through the list before we actually did the photograph, and would then prove, okay, yes, mm-hmm. this is what we eat.
Well, I think people in this country, you know, you realize what you shopped for necessarily, but you don't realize how many things you're eating outside of the house.
Exactly, and that was what was more difficult about photographing in the developed world, is that we had to show what people were having for lunch or dinner if they were eating in restaurants or cafeterias at work.
I love the picture of the family with the pizza boxes they were holding. They had two pizzas in the week, and I thought
right.
that was...
Yeah, you see, the American families, though, there's three American families that we shot in different parts of the country, different ethnic backgrounds, and pizza plays a big role in all of their diets.
I was when I looked at the American families in particular, I thought to myself, because I was a little shocked as well, but I sort of did the numbers myself because you detail what's there, and I thought, well, that makes sense. I mean, it's as unreasonable as it is, it didn't seem that unreasonable to me when I looked at it that way, but to see it all laid out in front of you, what my thought was, first of all, these people must be horrified for everyone mm-hmm. to know how much they eat, and secondly, looking back on our food roots, I thought, you know, these people could never be on a wagon train. You know what I mean? The whole wagon is filled up with a week's groceries.
They would be in the front, and then the rest of the wagons would be carrying their groceries.
Yeah. That's exactly what
I
thought.
I mean, you think about a family drinking 6 gallons of Coca-Cola in a week, and it's just horrifying.
But if you think of it 12 ounces at a time, it's not mm-hmm. that crazy.
But who drinks it 12 ounces at a time anymore?
That's true.
It's sort of appalling. I mean, we don't drink it at all. And so someone else is drinking our 55 gallons a year, which I
right.
think is what the average is.
Isn't that crazy?
Mm-hmm.
Now, culture to culture and place to place, did you find things... one of the things that I noticed in the book is that in the first world, we eat a lot more protein. And in America, the American families in particular, there's a lot of protein. Mm-hmm. Do you find that as nations get wealthier and follow American diet down this road, that we eat a lot more protein than we used to as a species?
Definitely.
Sure, it's inevitable. It's just the way that things... it's called the nutrition transition by anthropologists and nutritionists, and it's just the inevitable rush to protein and fatty and sugary foods once you have the money to afford it.
All you have to do is really watch what's happening in China, and you can actually see it on a very quick level. If you look at what... the population there was eating 20 years ago, and then 10 years ago, and then now, you will see that protein is playing a larger and larger role.
Yeah, and if you look at the pictures, we photographed two families in China too, a Beijing urban family and then a rural family. And it's so evident by comparing those two pictures that one of their diets contains a lot more packaged processed foods, and the other is much more basic and what is coming from their fields right around the house.
Now, but is that programmed in our DNA? Are we, as countries become more able to do that, as technology allows that to happen?
We're not scientists, so mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to hazard a guess even. But I would definitely say, though, that marketing may play more of a role than anything else.
You know, speaking of marketing and where we are culturally, did you find, having talked to so many people so broadly, we're seeing that on the high end of the market, you know, we talk all the time about sustainable agriculture, small producers, keeping family farmers on the farm, and how important that is. But one of the problems we face with a lot of the farmers with whom we work is that to produce food that way is more expensive. And so we're finding That's getting a lot of traction among people who have money. Do you think on the high end there's a new culture of people who's looking to eat locally, eat more traditionally, eat
most
less protein?
Definitely. Most definitely. And, that kind of thing, too, is coming from guys like you two,
mm-hmm.
Talking about it. But I think definitely as people get more food literacy and start realizing what they've lost, then they want to come back full circle. But there is an incredible population of people on the planet who haven't even gotten to that point, and they want to try it too. And who's to tell them that they can't? I'm not going to say, well, no, you shouldn't do this. It's bad for you. I might say that, but it's a free world, and people can try what they want. I think most times we will all come full circle, though, and start realizing, oh my gosh, the stuff that I'm putting in my body is probably not the best thing in the world for me.
Except those of us who die of diabetes will not come around full circle.
Right, we're not going to come full circle. But it's another amazing statistic is that one third of the children born in the country right now are going to have some form of diabetes in their lifetime. And that's just astounding in a country that spends $5,000 per person on health care, and yet we're some of the most unhealthy in the world.
I think one of the things that's very interesting, and I think that government does have a role and societies do have a role. There's a point at which if people become detached from the cultural moorings of their food, and before they can get to the point where they're highly educated, they listen to our show and they can afford their organic produce at Whole Foods, there is a point at which There is a huge educational effort being undertaken across the world, but especially in America, and it happens on your television and your commercials, and it happens with the cartoon on your box of cereal. I see, as I look through your book, as I look at the first world societies, the intense presence of branding. And the food manufacturer is not concerned whether you eat healthy food or not. They're concerned that you eat more of their food, and, corn syrup's cheap, right?
Well, that's exactly true, but I think that they don't care if you eat healthy, but they do care how people see them, and so that may be the only thing that is working in our collective healthy favor,
mm-hmm.
is the fact that more and more of them are having to sort of deal with the fact that we do want to eat more organically. But what I really worry about is that organic standards are really under attack, and
yeah.
Who knows what's going to happen? And I don't think that we're going to be in very good shape if indeed those are plundered.
Yeah, well, Francis and I were discussing the other day that our words are being taken away from us. Natural, organic. They're slowly being whittled down.
But the important thing to do is to publish books like yours and to keep talking about it. We can't let them take the language away from us, because if they take the language away from us, we can't talk about it.
But then we can invent new words.
We'll be back in just a moment with Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio talking about their book, Hungry Planet, What the World Eats. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps, to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guests today are Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio. Their current book is Hungry Planet, What the World Eats. Now, this book is beautiful.
Yeah,
I mean,
thank you.
It's
a good thing, huh?
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's a beautiful book. I have it literally on my coffee table. Of course, I was reading it again last night in preparation for the show, but it's, it could be a coffee table book, and it's a pretty book. you have to be surprised at how successful it is. I mean, everyone's talking about this book.
I'm never actually too surprised when our books are successful. Knock on wood, they've all done pretty well, mostly because Peter's really an amazing photojournalist and knows how to take a picture. His composition's beautiful. The pictures are incredibly, incredibly rich. What we bring to the party, we think, is the idea that a photography book does not need to be just pictures. And I'm a word person. I'm the writer. And, of course, I'm going to be sort of wedded to wanting to get every, absolutely every inch I can for text. But we create a nice balance, we think. And it's the kind of book we hope that people can pick up and learn something rather than just say, oh, that's a great picture.
But I do think that it's important to really look at the pictures, too, and really look at, you know, what people are eating in different places.
Of course. And they really drive the book. The pictures, there would be no book without those pictures.
It's crazy how, I mean, I like the premise of the book. I mean, I'm a foodie, and I'm a political foodie, you know, and I like it. But when I actually grabbed the book and look, it's like you're looking into all these different people's living rooms. In such a way, I mean, food is so tied to culture. Food is so tied to how people come together and interact as a family in a society. I think it was a very unique snapshot of the people overall. It wasn't about the food as much as it was about the food and the family and the culture. Was that your goal?
Yeah, all of our books, we basically do that. And we think it's important because you're right. Those two things are tied together. And, you know, the old adage, you are what you eat, is certainly true. You know, we also eat what we are, you know, if you look at it in the reverse. And all of these people really did open up their lives and let us, you know, we generally are pretty good at that, at sort of sitting down. Peter will share a meal with anybody. You know, I didn't particularly want to go to Greenland and be cold. Mm-hmm. I don't like to be cold. And that's why we live in California now, not New Jersey.
But eating Arctic char that's pulled right out of a glacial lake, you know, ice fishing or
eating
muskox.
Yeah, it was amazing. We caught a seal, and we had the muskox was really, really tremendous. And I'm happy when I look back at it. I wasn't so happy when I was there. I didn't like sitting on a dog sled.
I was
going to
say, without the sledding, everything would have been fine.
Yeah.
But was that the best meal you had? What was the most interesting thing that you discovered? I mean, this is kind of another low-hanging fruit question, but was there anything that you found surprising about a particular culture and its relationship to the food or a particular family that really caught you off guard?
Well, we've been traveling for a long, long time, but just going back to Chad quickly, I think it's kind of important for people just to know what's going on in refugee camps. And what we did is we photographed two families in Chad, one in a refugee camp and then one in a typical village. And they look dirt poor, but if you compare just looking at the pictures without reading any of the text or reading the statistics or reading the list of food, you can see that the people in the refugee camp are eating these grains and some oil, and the people in the village are eating grains and oil, but they're supplementing that with quite a large amount of vegetables, and there's some chickens, and they have some goats.
I think that's a really, really good point. Jamia, the mom in the refugee family, told me that, you know, that the things she missed most were her mango trees in Sudan. And I think a lot of people in this country, it's one of the reasons we do our books. A lot of the people, when they think of Africa, they think everybody's starving, and it's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who are starving. There are a lot of people who can barely make ends meet, but there are also people who are eating pretty well until they become displaced. And a lot of times famine is politically based, not weather-based.
Well, through the 70s and 80s, or even the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I think that, and 90s, I guess you'd have to add to that, this country lost a lot of its traditional farms. So I think people kind of fell away from having fruit fresh off a tree and fell away from having an ear of corn that had just been picked that morning and went more towards frozen things and canned things and products that were more processed and less fresh.
I think that dislodges us from our culture. And mm-hmm. I think when you look at what's going on in refugee camps, you know, if you're eating food out of the ground, you can, it's just a way to sympathize with other human beings that I think, you know, is sort of brought about by your book. I mean, do you find that there's a commonality that comes from food like that?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
We have a huge garden, our own selves, and our staff that works with us on our books eat from that garden, and anyone who comes to visit eats from that garden, and we give it away because we, you know, there's more zucchini coming out of that garden than I think, you know, exists in the rest of the planet. But
it's just the way that our country developed too. I mean, we just came back from Europe last week, and we were driving around France and Spain, and just noticing that every time you go into a town and you come out of a town, immediately you're in farmland,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that you're surrounded by what the people are eating.
Yeah, Peter was actually commenting on it. In a couple of cases, we just stopped just to stare because there's just something nice about being in a town and then being in farmland. And you know, we live in Napa, where farmland has basically all become grapes,
mm-hmm.
and so it's one giant monoculture. One good bug is going to knock out the entire county.
Yeah. Well, it almost did.
I've heard you speak about different cultures having different attitudes towards food, and especially the Japanese family that you photographed. Talking about how some cultures, it's to eat everything on your plate is part of the culture, and in other cultures, you're sort of supposed to walk away hungry. Have you found those attitudes changing?
That's one of the most important things that I think people might be able to come away from this book with is learning what harahajabu means, and that means 80%. And what Japanese people have done is that they've taught their kids, and they've been taught to not stuff themselves, but to sort of push themselves away from the table before their brain is really saying that their stomach is full. And physiologically, when your stomach is 80% full, that's when you should stop eating, because you really are full at that point.
Your stomach needs to catch up.
To know it yet.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, and one of the things that I'm using anecdotes that I have, a very good friend of mine was brought up. His family's from Taiwan, and he came to the restaurant one day, and he said to me after a great big meal, he said, "You know what? I just can't stand this feeling." I'm like, "What's the matter?" He's like, "I'm really full, and I just ate too much, and I hate this feeling." And I realized what the problem was.
Mm-hmm.
I love that feeling.
And that's why Mark is a big Italian guy whose family's from Brooklyn, and Johnny Sue's family is from Taiwan. And there we have your point illustrated very clearly in my dining room. Hey, Peter and Faith, thank you so much for coming on to talk about your book.
Sure, thanks for having us.
It's super, and we're going to link you out there in the audience. You can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and figure out how to get this book. It's a tremendous addition for you to have on your coffee table. There are some recipes in there. The pictures are beautiful, and there's some really good points you might learn about food in America and around the world. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. The book we've been talking about today is Hungry Planet, What the World Eats by Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio. I recommend you pick up the book. You can find out about it at restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll link you to a place where you can pick
Peter
it up.
Peter was talking earlier, and Faith, they were talking about that Peter is a photojournalist, and that's really his calling. It's really a pretty
book.
It's
a beautiful
book. With great pictures that you know, they say picture says 1,000 words. These pictures say more than 1,000 words.
But one of the things that this sort of juxtaposition and this anthropological look at different families and their food, one of the things you're definitely seeing is you're seeing foods change. And you're seeing as people come away from their cultural moorings and come into, you know, if you walk around one of the poorer neighborhoods in Jersey City, and Jersey City has some nice neighborhoods, you can find Burger King and McDonald's everywhere, but you go and try and find
An apple,
mm-hmm. You know, and that's it's difficult to navigate abundance. And we've had food experts and flavor experts and psychologists on the show in the past talk about navigating such tremendous abundance. And this much variety of choice that we all have is great, but it also comes with a great responsibility. Because, look, if you eat 7 foodstuffs, your body is pretty well adapted to let you know when you've had enough.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, all right, enough with the gruel.
I don't think it's just that. They talked about in the show that variety, that the more variety, the more choices we have, that generally the more obese the society is. And I was thinking about that while they were on the show. And they said they weren't scientists, so I didn't really want to talk about much more about it. But, you know, part of that is you're only going to eat so much of a certain food.
Right.
You're going to grow tired of it. You're going to grow... you know, you're not going to overeat that food every single day. If you're eating lentils every day, you're just not going to gorge yourself on lentils.
Right, but after you're
day
full of,
7.
But after you're full of the lentils, you might want a Snickers bar and a pizza.
Exactly.
You know, and you might want to have a beer and a cherry Coke. And You know, we have such great abundance here. And why do we do this show? It's because we need to talk about stuff like this. And we need to talk about how to eat well. And we need to talk about how to set up our society so that people of all economic backgrounds can eat well, which is something we really have to work on. That's a paradigm we need to change in the future. And most importantly, what we talk about all the time is being able to stay educated and to educate our children to help them eat well. We are in an epidemic, and we do need to eat good foods, and we do need to eat locally and stay more to our traditions or create good traditions.
I thought we did the show because we had nothing to do between 11 and 12 every day.
Oh, that's true, too. Let's go have some lunch. Hope you enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis.
And I'm Mark.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.